From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Ruth Bader Ginsburg revealed today that her cancer has returned. The 87-year-old Supreme Court justice says she is receiving chemotherapy and that she plans to keep working. We will be watching the implications of that story.
Meanwhile, the debate over wearing masks is intensifying. Arkansas and Colorado are the latest states to mandate people wear masks in public. And in Georgia, Republican Governor Brian Kemp is waffling on mask wearing. First, suing Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, who's a Democrat, to stop her from enforcing local mask requirements. And then today, urging residents to wear masks in public. And in Albuquerque, New Mexico, hundreds gathered yesterday to protest wearing masks as well as quarantine orders and lockdown measures during the pandemic. Steve Smotherman, a pastor at Legacy Church in Albuquerque, spoke to the crowd.
To see how America has just so easily been manipulated and told what to do without even a fight. And today we start fighting.
Local NBC affiliate KOB4 reports they did not see any citations handed out to protesters who were not wearing masks. Let's bring in Tim Keller, who is the mayor of Albuquerque. And Mayor Keller, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Mayor, you announced earlier this week that you were going to step up enforcement on mask wearing in your city. But at least at this latest protest, that did not happen. What's your response to the action taken there?
Well, for us, our folks are basically saying, look, it's important that we understand the constitutional tension here if it's an actual protest, and also just respect the concept of de-escalation. So in our town, if it is a scheduled, you know, mass protest outside, both the mask gathering and the mask ban isn't being heavily enforced, but we're not allowing folks to pretend that when they don't want to wear a mask at a restaurant or a grocery store, that just doesn't fly. And so we're enforcing that heavily.
Tell us a little bit more about those plans to beef up enforcement in places like restaurants. What's your strategy beyond calling the police on people?
Yeah, we're taking a different approach. And what we're doing is we're using basically city employees who deal with areas around either public health or code or permitting. So firefighters, our health inspectors, our code inspectors, and even like our parking security folks, which are unarmed. They, in their life, I mean, they do deal with individuals who don't want to do what they tell them, and they often will issue fines or inspection fees and things of that nature, even like our fire marshal's office. So they're at least a little bit used to that sort of contentious interaction. But from a bigger perspective, we're testing out a larger idea. Our city announced about 6 weeks ago that, you know, we're trying to create a third department of law enforcement. And so those police, fire, and then community safety department. And this was a way to sort of decriminalize a lot of low-level interactions and mental health and behavioral health actions. And so this mask enforcement is actually a trial for us to create an entirely new department when you call even something like 911.
What you're doing is in the name of public health. It's a public health measure, but this whole issue has become so political. You're a Democrat. New Mexico's governor is a Democrat. How do you lead a city through a crisis like this when there's so much political polarization in this country and about this issue?
Well, it's been very difficult. There's no doubt. I think the only concept that we've used that seems to resonate is just saying that in Albuquerque, we have to carve our own path. So we have to do things that make sense for our community. And in our city, we did outperform our peers over the last 6 months. So we were much healthier than Austin, Denver, Phoenix. And we're actually using that as a rallying cry to stay that way.
But you are, you know, New Mexico is sandwiched right in between Arizona and Texas. Those two states are seeing COVID-19 cases explode. How concerned are you about this? You know, borders are kind of imaginary when we really think about it in terms of something like a health crisis like COVID-19.
It's very true. And we are doing a couple things in the city. One is we have real strong enforcement at the airport. So you cannot go in our airport without a mask. And we're also doing some inquiries with respect to our quarantine rules. If we do see out-of-state license plates and things like this, we will certainly go in and ask, how long have you been in this state and so forth?
Oh, really?
You remind them of the quarantine rules. Yeah, so we're trying to be targeted and smart in our enforcement approach where we're really concerned, which is the nexus of out-of-state folks being inside and being together. That's an area where we would go in and ask all of those questions and try and remove folks from those facilities if they won't wear masks.
That's Tim Keller. He is the mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico, talking about the new mask order. Mayor Keller, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Great questions.
Time to get an update on the race to develop a coronavirus vaccine. The World Health Organization counts 23 trials happening around the world, and stat reporter Helen Branswell is keeping track. Helen, the big development was from Moderna this week. Early trials of its vaccine seem to be working.
Well, you know, it's good news. I mean, vaccine development is a very finicky line of work. So far, so good with the Moderna one. It was the phase one data that we saw this week, very small trial. That's standard for a phase one. That trial is not designed to see if it works. That trial is designed to see if it's safe to continue to use and to try to figure out what the appropriate dose is. But in this case, it looks like the vaccine is triggering production of antibodies, most specifically neutralizing antibodies, which are the ones you really want to see. So that's a good sign. It's certainly, as somebody I spoke to this week suggested, reason to continue to pursue this vaccine.
So that's one that many people are going to keep a close eye on. What about this vaccine in the United Kingdom? It's a project between Oxford University and AstraZeneca, already in phase three human tests. What should we know about that?
That one was fast out of the gate. And so far, I think it, you know, is looking promising. There was a study in non-human primates that kind of raised some concerns, not from a safety point of view, but from the point of view of the fact that it didn't seem to block infection, but it blocked disease. So, you know, we may be looking at a situation where these vaccines can't stop you from getting the sniffles or even getting, you know, what feels like a light bout of a flu-like illness, but they may prevent you from going on to having severe disease or, you know, even requiring hospitalization. The human data are what everybody's going to be waiting to see.
Well, in considering how much of a race is on right now to get this virus under control, is anyone talking about human challenge trials, which would purposefully infect a participant in a trial, right?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk about that all spring. And in the UK, they may be thinking about doing it. The National Institutes of Health here have been looking at the issue as well. The fact of the matter is, it takes quite a long time to develop a human challenge model. And some of the vaccines that are in development now, if they work, will likely know they work before a human challenge model could be implemented and put into use. I think initially there was a sense that you could put together a human challenge trial very quickly. And that is just simply not the case. The other thing is that human challenge trials are very small trials because you're effectively putting people at risk. You're exposing them to a virus that can kill. So there are really big ethical questions about that. And generally speaking, scientists who do challenge studies prefer to do them when there is a therapeutic that you know will save a patient if they develop severe disease. And we're not in that situation right now with COVID-19. So certainly for some people, the ethics around this are still pretty dicey.
By the way, how are the Chinese doing on their pursuit of a vaccine?
Oh, well, they were out of the gate really quickly. They have quite a few vaccines at various stages of development. And in fact, they have one vaccine that they've already given, you know, their equivalent of what the FDA calls an emergency use authorization. They're using it in the Chinese military. Sinovac, a Chinese company, has a phase three trial already of a vaccine that's an inactivated vaccine, which is a very old style of vaccine. You take the virus and you kill it and use that as the trigger to induce an immune response. So they have multiple vaccines in development at the moment, and several of them are already, you know, well along in clinical trials.
So I hear from you some kind of optimism just on the way that this is advancing time-wise, but also from these results that we've been getting recently that things kind of seem to be working. That makes me also want to be skeptical. How confident should we be that this is going to be in place, ready to go, end of the year, beginning of the year, as some people are hoping for?
Well, you know, vaccine development is a very tricky business. It's actually quite uncommon for everything to fall into place really, you know, beautifully. So I think people need to be, you know, temper their expectations about how early vaccine is going to be ready. Obviously, the administration would like to have it early, even before the election, if possible. I guess we're going to see.
Indeed. Helen Branswell, reporter for STAT, thanks for the update.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now, where independent minds get their start.
Let's check in with an activist who is still out protesting in Minneapolis nearly 2 months after the death of George Floyd. Misky Noor is with the group Black Visions and joins us on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And is that right? You're still out there protesting every day?
Yeah, and definitely out here. And whether it's, you know, being at the memorial site or talking to community members or attending budget hearings or, yeah, looks like a lot of different things, but still out here in the streets talking to our community members about what abolition can look like here in Minneapolis.
You're referring to police abolition, I assume.
That's right. Yeah.
And why? What are you still looking for?
Well, right now we are in the process of getting a charter amendment on the ballot in November. We want to defund the police and eventually move towards the full abolition of them. And so the first step to actually making that possible is getting rid of all of the different bureaucratic measures that literally write the police into our everyday lives. And that is a part of what we're currently still fighting for.
Now, I remember a few weeks ago, some members of the Minneapolis City Council had promised that they were going to move forward with this kind of effort and they were going to defund the police. And it hasn't happened yet. And as you know, I mean, a lot of people will hear something like that and be scared, will be, what are you talking about? Like, how could you possibly do something like that? What does defund the police or abolish the police mean? Do you actually mean no more police?
I do. We do. Yes, 100%. We do mean that. You know, the city council made that promise on Prince's birthday.
Local hero. Yeah,
I know. Right. And which was really amazing. And it was the first step because they actually made a public commitment. Of course, people are scared, but our people don't know life without police, right? And can't imagine it in so many ways. So as organizers and as abolitionists, it's our responsibility to hold people in their fear and then ask them the questions of what actually do keep them safe.
So let me just throw a hypothetical out there, which is unfortunately not a hypothetical really in this country. What if someone comes to a protest in Minneapolis with a long gun, starts opening fire, and there's no police? I mean, cause, you know, that's what people are afraid of, really, in some ways.
Yeah, like, I understand that fear for sure. What I'd say to them is that happens now. I was involved in the 18-day police occupation of the 4th Police Precinct when Jamar Clark was murdered. It's about to be the 5th year anniversary of his murder this coming November. And while we were protesting, white supremacists came and shot at us, and 5 people were shot, and the police were right there and did nothing. Right.
But that's not how it normally is. I mean, normally if someone comes, you know, aims a rifle out of a hotel window in Las Vegas and starts opening fire, every police officer in the city arrives, you know, so that, you know.
Right. But that, even that is a very specific example of a particular kind of violence. What we're saying is that if we're able to move towards a police-free future, lots of violence should hopefully not be possible, right? Another favorite statistic to throw out there is like, what are we going to do about the rapists, right? Mm-hmm. In Minneapolis, currently, the police only clear about 20% of rape cases. What we're saying is that whatever it is that we're envisioning together to move towards is much safer than what currently exists. Because what currently exists is a police system that is entrenched in and comes from slave catching and union busting, and that is incapable of keeping so many of us in mostly marginalized communities safe.
As you know, conservatives are using these terms, you know, defund the police, deactivate the police, and they're using it to their advantage, they think, in the upcoming presidential election, you know, trying to say that this is proof that the left is alienating people. Do you see that you might lose some people and potentially hand Donald Trump the presidency if you push the party or the left too far?
I don't think so. I think that before the murder of George Floyd, I think a lot of people would have said exactly what you just said. Mm-hmm. And now it's a different world. We're inside of a pandemic. And inside of that, there's been police terror, which has led to an uprising. And now there's an economic recession on the way, most likely. And for a lot of that is because of the missteps and poor decision making of the current president. And the voters and the people will reckon with him for that. I feel really proud of and really excited about the ways that my community members have taken abolition from theory into practice. Feels really exciting about what is possible here in Minneapolis, especially, I think, and not fearful.
That's Miski Noor with the group Black Visions, still protesting on the streets of Minneapolis, almost 2 months since the death of George Floyd. Miski, thank you. Appreciate the time.
Thanks, Peter.
Here's a question. Can racism cause dementia? It's a question researchers are looking deeply into as emerging science shows that segregation and discrimination may be contributing factors as to why Black people are more likely than white people to develop Alzheimer's disease. For more, we have Rachel Whitmer, professor and chief of the epidemiology department at the University of California, Davis. And Dr. Whitmer, we know Black people are more at risk for dementia. Do we even fully understand the mechanisms at work here?
That's a great question. And the short answer is no, we don't fully understand the mechanisms. What we do know is that in studies sourced from memory clinics, as well as large population-based studies, Black Americans are 75% to 100%, so that's twice as likely to have dementia. And the most common subtype of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. We also know Black Americans are also more likely to carry a lot of the risk factors for dementia. So I think a big question for us is that if we can change the distribution of these risk factors, can we change this disparity that we see in rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
And when you talk about risk factors, you're talking about health factors as well as environmental?
Yes, correct. So we've known for some time that what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So heart health equals brain health. And at a population level, we do see higher rates, for example, of hypertension. So at a population level, we know that Black Americans have a bit more of these other health risk factors that put one at higher risk for dementia.
Mm. You've talked about a theory that exposure to segregation could have contributed to cognitive decline among Black elders. Can you explain?
Yes. So we've done some work on birthplace. So we have a very large study where we're following several thousand older Americans in Northern California. And those who report that they were born in a state from the South in the Stroke Belt are at a higher risk of dementia, even though they subsequently moved and were living in Northern California by the 1960s and the 1970s.
And when you say the Stroke Belt, you're talking about Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, those types of places.
Yes. So people who were born in one of those states are at higher risk of dementia, whether they're Black or white. But we know that in our study, our older Black research participants are 10 times more likely to have been born in one of those states. And we know historically what happened in those states. We also know quality and quantity of education also has a large effect on risk of dementia. And so for our next step, we're trying to go back and pull information about schools that people attended and try to get an assessment of the quality of the education, because we think this is a large driver of the disparity that we see in rates of dementia.
How else could racism in the public health sphere and really in general be playing into what you're finding about the development of dementia?
Yes. Researchers also think this is why we see more hypertension, that this is not a physiological mechanism necessarily, but a response to stress and to stress that is experienced by being a Black American today. And so we also know that high levels of stress is bad for inflammation. It's bad for sleep. It's bad for brain function, all these things that are linked with brain health. And so in our current studies right now, we are asking questions about everyday and lifetime discrimination. And we're trying to really understand, how does this have an effect on one's cognitive function and risk for dementia late in life?
You know, I'm thinking about those at most risk for coronavirus. We're living through this pandemic that has shown how little society values our elders, as well as protesters taking to the streets to really speak out about how little the U.S. values Black lives. Do you think there's enough research right now being done into dementia and chronic illnesses in older Black populations? Of course, your study is happening, but this is emerging science that we've been hearing about for a few years with maternal mortality, for instance, but still very little that we're hearing about this type of science.
Yes. Well, I think one of the positive outcomes is more attention to health inequities. And what's happening with the coronavirus is emblematic of what we see with dementia, with hypertension, and with maternal death. And so I think, you know, it's time for science to pay attention. And I know that the National Institute of Health is really pushing for researchers to have diversity in their studies. And I always say it's not enough to recruit research participants that reflect the population today. We need to recruit research participants that reflect the population of tomorrow. Now, there is a history of distrust with research for Black Americans with very good reason. And so there is a whole science around engagement in research and building trust with different communities and having communities understand that we want to improve their health. And that's why we want to include them in our research.
Rachel Whitmer is a professor and chief of the epidemiology department at the University of California, Davis. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's being called one of the most significant hacks in the last decade, and there's a chance that the hackers have a larger, more nefarious plan up their sleeve. Wednesday's Twitter attack hijacked the accounts of high-profile people like Elon Musk and Barack Obama, tweeting a fake Bitcoin deal, with the ramifications extending further than a single money-making scheme. And to get a sense of that magnitude, let's bring in NPR's tech reporter Bobby Allen. And Bobby, Twitter is now saying that hackers used a social engineering strategy to take over a Twitter employee's account and credentials, which gave them control over these accounts. What do we know about this?
Right. So social engineering, as you mentioned, is this term that comes from cybercrime. And it's basically when a hacker researches you, figures out who your friends are, who your connections are, where you live, where you work, things like that, and then uses that info to deceive you. So they could send you a friend request from someone, you know, pretending to be an acquaintance, or like, you know, someone can send you a work email and it looks like it's coming from a colleague. And then once you open it, malware could be launched on your computer and hackers could start hijacking. Now, at Twitter, getting that kind of administrative access doesn't just let you tweet from someone's account, but it does give you the power to change an email associated with accounts. So researchers who've been looking at the hack that happened this week says that's what probably happened here, that hackers changed the emails of 130 accounts of some of the richest and most famous people and then tweeted out this Bitcoin scam.
Okay, a big question that everyone probably has is whether Twitter has said anything about whether employees helped these hackers.
Yeah, and exactly. That's probably the biggest question right now. Was it an inside job? So far, Twitter's been suggesting the opposite, right? That they were a target of an attack from these hackers right when their guard was down. But they have not definitively ruled out that one of their own helped the hackers. And, you know, there are unconfirmed reports on some tech blogs sort of exploring the idea that that a Twitter insider coordinated with the hackers. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's just open for debate. We don't know just yet.
Okay, so this time it was a Bitcoin scam, but experts point out that this kind of strategy before an election could really be catastrophic. What are the implications of this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's really worrisome thinking about the November election, isn't it? I mean, I think this Twitter hack should, you know, really put us all on guard. I mean, social media platforms, as we all know, like Twitter and Facebook, are enormously powerful in our democracy. And, you know, they basically shape the kind of discourse we're having day to day. They influence how we vote. And, you know, with things like voter registration systems moving online and with a big presidential election in November, you know, the fact that these tech companies can be compromised and control the channels of communication just should make us really, really vigilant.
Yeah, but the 30 seconds I have with you, what is Twitter saying they're going to do about this?
So when it happened, Twitter locked down the platform and suspended verified users from tweeting. That was unprecedented and shocked a lot of people. Now they're doing a deep dive of the incident, and they're being helped by the FBI and by state authorities. And the big focus right now at Twitter is answering these two questions. How did this happen? And how can we make sure we build the defenses so that it never happens again?
That's NPR tech reporter Bobby Allen talking about the hack that breached 130 private accounts, including presidential candidate Joe Biden's account. Bobby, thank you.
Thanks, Tani.
In the past 19 years, the United States has deployed nearly 3 million service members to Iraq and Afghanistan. Over half have been deployed more than once. And the burden of those deployments falls not only on those who serve, but also on their families. A new Netflix documentary, Father, Soldier, Son, examines that toll. It follows the Aish family over the course of a decade. Brian, the single father of two boys, Isaac and Joey, but also a platoon sergeant who's deployed to Afghanistan.
I question myself every day if I'm doing the right thing for my kids. You know, I'm trying to do my duty to my country and deploy, you know, and do what Uncle Sam asks me to do. But, you know, what's everybody asking my boys to do?
Over the years, we learn what's asked of the boys, and the answer is at times heartbreaking. Leslie Davis and Katrin Einhorn are co-directors and producers of Father, Soldier, Son. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Katrin Einhorn is on a Skype line. Katrin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Katrin, I want to start with you because you are the journalist who first met Brian Aish back in 2010. How did you meet him and what drew you to him?
Well, I'm the one who first met his boys, actually. So I was part of a team in 2010. We were following one battalion over their year-long deployment to Afghanistan. It was, you know, during President Obama's troop surge, he was sending an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. And I flew to Wisconsin to meet these young boys, you know, whose dad was deployed. And they had been deployed in their own way to their uncle's house because he was a single dad. So they had gone, you know, left everything they knew in upstate New York to go live with their uncle in central Wisconsin while their dad was away. And they were just such compelling little people. You know, wow. They were so honest and open and they shared their emotions. But it was also so clear how they were just trying so hard to be strong and to live up to the values that, you know, were expected of them.
One of the opening scenes was at the airport as they're saying goodbye to their dad. And you're right. They're trying so hard to be brave, not to cry, but they can't hold it back. Tell me more. Yusuf, where do you think they got that? Was that from their dad?
Yeah, I think from the time that these boys can remember, like they've been taught that serving your country is the utmost honor, one of the utmost honors in life. And it requires certain sacrifices and it requires you know, Brian would talk to them about his patriotic duty. This was his patriotic duty. And so they certainly tried to live up to that idea.
Leslie, I want to bring you in because there was a sacrifice involved because, you know, shortly after Brian was deployed in Afghanistan, he was seriously wounded, shot in the leg. And I think that's where you come into this story. You know, tell me about your impressions of that wound, that physical wound, and what it did to him emotionally.
Yeah, so Brian, overcoming the inability to walk, dealing with the pain, figuring out whether or not he should keep his wounded leg, I think that stuff was on par with the struggle that he had figuring out who he was because the injury forced him out of the military. So we saw how this physical wound affected a man who really found strength and power in his ability to perform, but also this psychological wound of not knowing who he was when he could no longer serve his country.
Right. His identity is in question for himself. Leslie, I want to stick with you here. At one point, he says he feels guilty because he's not mission ready anymore. In other words, he's been injured. It's the government that has to take care of him. He can't do what he used to do with his kids. You know, and all through this pain, you know, he still remains patriotic and loyal and never really grapples, to me, it seems, with the idea that it was, in fact, his government that sent him to war and that put him in harm's way in many ways, even though it seems like he volunteered, you know, to go. What do you think about that? Did he ever feel that his country left him behind?
So I think that Brian really prides himself in being a patriot, and he will say that himself. I think on micro levels could find himself critical of the system and the government when it came to the delays in getting treatment for his leg or just the amount of difficulty he had filing paperwork for certain things. But on a more macro level, criticizing the country goes against very much who Brian is. He definitely had a hard time reconciling the position that he had been put in as a soldier and the things that he experienced because of what was called for by the government for him. You know, the sacrifices that he made leaving his sons, the sacrifices he made being injured, the position it left him in when he got out. Those are not things that Brian has an easy time reckoning with in a very overt way.
Hmm. You can hear his influence on his boys. We're going to play a little bit of tape here. This is the youngest, Joey.
I really liked the military life, and that kind of got me into the wanting to join the army because I love the army life.
He says he loves the military life. And then here's Isaac, his eldest boy.
When I was younger, I was always 100% military. Let's go military, put on a uniform and go overseas. But when I actually thought about it, I mean, I'd like to be close to family. I do want to have kids eventually, and I don't want my kids to go through what I went through. I'm pretty sure that they'd want a dad around more than anything else.
Katrin, to me, what you captured through these kids is the complexity of what it means to be a boy in this country and to grow into a young man, and that in this family, just like in many families, you have to be tough to survive, right? Like, do you think those boys really felt that growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I think even Brian felt that, you know, himself. He said to us, you know, that he thought one of the hardest things about being a boy was being tough enough. And I think that, you know, from his perspective, like he's trying to prepare his kids for what life is going to ask of them. And that means really creating a toughness in them. And he thinks that that's going to serve them well.
What did we learn about parenthood through Brian? You know, because he's both, just like any of us, he's both flawed and wonderful at the same time as a father.
I think what we really got to see by sticking with this family for so many years and you know, doing this thing that journalists don't often get to do, which is to really follow the story over a very long amount of time, is we got to see how these values were handed down from one generation to the next, right? And that's what parents do. It's really quite a universal thing. Right, to see how the beliefs that shaped Brian end up shaping his boys. And we got to see that really by sticking with the story.
Well, and by sticking with the story, Leslie, you encountered some absolutely heart-wrenching, traumatic developments in this family's life. And, you know, I don't want to give away any of the plot points here. Suffice it to say, they're horrible. And you knew this family over the course of so many years. How did you deal with some of the things that you encountered with them?
I think that it was really difficult. You know, you have to figure out, who am I in this moment? Am I a journalist? Am I a human? Of course, we had a lot of feelings. We were absolutely devastated by what happened with the family and seeing what they went through and the pain that they were feeling. It was hard because we were there as journalists and we were there as filmmakers, and we really had to be professional, pull ourselves together and do our job. But at the same time, we were definitely grieving alongside them.
How often would you see them over the course of a year?
It varied a lot, actually. So I think in the years where we saw them the most, there might have been a trip every month or a trip every other month. And then sometimes we would go many months without seeing them. It just depended on where they were and what was happening in their lives. And we definitely stayed in touch with them and tracked bigger events that were happening or things that we knew spoke to the themes that we were exploring. But we also did have some trips where we went just to observe life and to be there embedded with them when they were living kind of what I think they would consider their normal everyday lives.
Yeah. And Catherine, when you had to deal with some of the most traumatic experiences, do you think that ultimately the family was happy that they let you into their lives for so long?
Yeah, they were so generous in sharing their lives with us and allowing us to tell this story. And we did fly to their home and show them the film. And it was, you know, they laughed and they cried watching it. And at the very end, Brian turned to us and said, "It's true." And I think he finds real meaning, actually, in sharing the experiences that he and his family have been through.
That's Catherine Einhorn and Leslie Davis, co-directors and co-producers of the new Netflix documentary, Father, Soldier, Son. I wish I had known when I started watching this that I should have had a box of tissues along with me.
But there are very joyous moments,
oh,
too.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? There are very joyous moments, too.
There absolutely are, but you captured it all, which is the point, right? Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for watching.
John Anderson is the distinctive voice behind more than two dozen country hits, including Swingin' Black Sheep and Seminole Wind. He's a respected country elder who thought his performing days might be over after he lost his hearing because of a health crisis. Julie Height reports on how his road to recovery has led to a weighty new album.
You might not think of Florida as a hotbed of country music, but it sure inspired John Anderson.
And way down south in the Everglades, where the black water rolls and the sawgrass waves, the eagles fly and the otters play in the land of the Seminole.
Growing up, he listened to everything from bluegrass to rock and roll and worked in the orange groves to get money for a guitar. Anderson wasted no time getting to Nashville as soon as he graduated high school in 1972. He quickly landed a gig at the Grand Ole Opry House as a roofer. But since the Opryland theme park next door was in need of performers for its live shows, he figured he'd try out.
We went through the music part of the auditions and then came up the choreography part of the auditions, and I went home. I told the lady I didn't dance. Actually, I still don't.
Neither did the iconic country singers that Anderson studied while developing the bluesy bends and billowy volume control of his own vocal style.
As much as I loved Merle and George, I was told early on, son, they don't need any help. You better find you a sound of your own. So by the time I had a major record deal, I felt like I was singing like John Anderson.
Hey, I'm just an old chunk of coal. But I'm gonna be a diamond someday.
He soon had a signature look, too. A beard and long curly mane topped by a cowboy hat. Early on, it linked him more to the unruly outlaws than decorous country elders like Roy Acuff.
Roy Acuff told me I needed to get a haircut, and I didn't play the Opry anymore for 24 years, so that'll tell you how things were about the long hair.
Even so, Anderson earned fans and hits with his hard country sound and often rollicking songs.
Little sister married a banker, yeah, he owns a country club. He bought her a big old racing horse and a funny looking little dog.
His recording career slowed in the 2000s, but he stayed in the touring circuit and became a respected veteran of the scene himself and a member of the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. In 2018, Anderson got an unexpected invitation from Black Keys frontman Dan Auerbach and his producing partner David Ferguson. They were calling on seasoned Nashville pros for all sorts of studio projects, and Anderson was under the impression they wanted to write songs for other singers. As Auerbach recalls,
"Even when we wrote that first day, we wrote Years, he had me sing the demo. First few times we wrote, he didn't really do much singing, and he never really explained why until later."
Anderson still prefers not to talk much about the health ordeal that had sent him to the hospital for surgery, except to say,
"I was able to play and sing even as sick as I was, but when I lost my hearing and couldn't hear my guitar anymore, there was a real problem there, and the doctors didn't know if I would ever get my hearing back."
There were times when Anderson had to put his ear right next to the sound hole of his guitar to craft a melody that matched the chords. His brush with mortality seeped into the lyrics of a tune he wrote with Auerbach and an old friend from the Nashville songwriting scene, Paul Overstreet.
"You know, I talked about a soldier with stress syndrome and some of the troubles that they go through. And while we were sitting there, I was kind of writing it about some other guy. But I'm afraid Dan and Paul might have been writing it about me."
Anderson concedes it suits his story, too.
"I'm still hanging on. I'm still hanging on. There were people making bets that I'd be dead and gone. Oh, but I'm still hanging on."
The two producers convinced Anderson to start recording these songs and see how it went. Auerbach says they were prepared for anything.
"We had different types of headphones set up. We even had like speaker playback set up for him. And we just all crossed our fingers. And he started singing and it was perfectly in key. And it sounded so good. It was him, you know, unmistakable voice."
"In a dream last night I saw her. She was dancing on the water. And when I went to touch her, she disappeared down under."
Even by the time that I finished and could hear them, I knew that it felt great, but I couldn't hear well enough to really judge how well I sounded. They all told me that it sounded great, and I took their word for it.
That was well before the pandemic hit. Now John Anderson hopes that others who hear him sing about weathering hardships, savoring affection, and clinging to faith will find it a little easier to hang on themselves. For NPR News, I'm Julie Height in Nashville.
"What makes a man keep chasing down a dream?"
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.